Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome.
Today's episode of The Stacks is brought to you by Libro FM. Many of you have asked me why I recently made the switch from Audible to Libro FM, and it's really for one reason. I love independent bookstores. Libro FM made it possible for me to listen to audiobooks and still support the bookstores in my community. I'm encouraging you all to do the same. Put your purchasing dollars behind a website that works in partnership with local businesses in your community. For every audiobook purchase, a portion of your book sale goes directly towards an independent bookstore of your choosing. It's really easy, and you still get the same great audiobook you would on any other website, but you get to know your purchase is sending money back into your neighborhood. Libro FM is making it easy for you to get started with an offer of 3 audiobooks for the price of 1 when you use the code THESTACKS. All you have to do is go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and use the code THESTACKS at checkout. So next time you're thinking of getting an audiobook, consider making the switch to Libro FM. Your favorite booksellers will thank you. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas. It is The Stacks Book Club Day here, and we are talking about The Giver by Lois Lowry with my mom, Sue Thomas. The Giver is a book aimed at children that examines a utopian society that is based on the idea of sameness. We talk today about collective memory, teaching young people about atrocities in history, and why we think this book works so well for both children and adults. There are a lot of spoilers on today's episode. Make sure that you listen to the end of today's episode to hear the Stacks Book Club pick for June. Just a reminder, everything we discuss on today's show can be found in the link in the show notes. Okay, let's talk with my mom about The Giver by Lois Lowry. All right, everybody, I am back again today with my mom, Sue Thomas. We are discussing The Giver by Lois Lowry. There are going to be a lot of spoilers today, so if you have not read the book yet, I would recommend pausing and coming back after you read it, or you could just be okay with getting spoiled, and that's fine too, but we're going to talk about the whole book in detail. So that's your warning. Mom, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be back.
For everybody who's listening, just a quick rundown of the book. The book is called The Giver. It's by Lois Lowry. It won the Newbery Medal, I believe, in 1994. The book came out in 1993. It is the story of Jonas, who is a young boy living in a utopian society. He turns 12 and gets his life assignment, which is to become the receiver of memories. The book then kind of shifts around, and then we'll just get talking about it. But basically, it's a utopian, dystopian story. So, Mom, we always start here. What did you think of the book?
I like the book very much. It definitely makes you think about the meaning of life and what makes life valuable.
So, for me, I had read this book when I was a kid, I think in fifth grade, and I remember really loving it, but I didn't really remember the book at all, like the contents of the book. And so, rereading it was kind of a fun experience for me because I felt like, I know I like this. I can't wait to figure out why I like this so much. And I think it lived up to my memory. I really thought that the book, though it's for middle grade kids, though it's for, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh graders, I felt like it also was really good at connecting with the adult audience as well. How did you feel about reading the book as an adult?
I actually didn't feel like it was only directed at a young audience. I actually felt like it was really an adult book as well.
I definitely felt like this was a kid's book. Like, I didn't feel like this was an adult book for sure, because there are parts of the book where I felt like she's doing vocabulary words, or like, oh, this is a word that would be new to a fifth grader. And a lot of that happened kind of early in the book. And I felt like, you know, the whole part with like the stirrings, right, which were, my assumption is that that was a wet dream. If it had been for adults, like, I think they would have gone into that. There would have been a whole thing about, you know, sex and desire and all this. So it definitely felt like this book is for children. I think that it's well done, and it's kind of like a Disney movie, that it works on multiple levels, right? Like a Pixar movie, there's this whole storyline that works for kids, and then as an adult watching it, you're like, oh my God, this movie's about grief and moving on without a parent and all this stuff. But as a kid, you're like, this movie is about the Little Mermaid and meeting the prince. So I felt like it definitely worked on both levels, but it certainly felt aimed at young people for sure for me. Which is not to say that I didn't get a lot out of it. Like, I definitely appreciated the book as an adult, but I was very aware that it was aimed at children.
Well, I definitely agree with you that a lot of her vocabulary that she used was written to a younger audience. But the emotional engagement really worked for me now in my life. And I feel like, that's why she's such an amazing author, because she got the point across. And exactly, just like Disney, it hits you on a lot of different levels.
Yeah. One of the things that I thought was really funny, speaking of vocabulary words, is that I remember, this is such a small, weird memory, but when I was rereading the book, I'm reading it. And one of the things that stuck out that I remembered as a kid, as a vocabulary word that I remember an adult explaining to me, was the word annex, because that's where the giver is. He's in the annex. And I that word, for whatever reason, like, stuck in my mind, the annex. This must have been where I learned what an annex was.
Exactly.
Which I honestly still don't know what it is, but like that's the first time I ever heard that word. So that was kind of a funny moment for me, being like, oh my God, this is the annex book.
I think an annex here would mean an extra structure, a separate building.
I was thinking of it more as like a separate room, kind of like a sunroom.
It could be. An annex could be.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's how I'd envisioned it in my mind.
You know what came to my mind from you reading it as a child is I remember you sitting in the bathtub, and I don't know if it was this book or Number of the Stars, but me sitting in the bathtub in the bathroom with you, and I was reading it, and for some reason, I feel like when the discussion came to colors, which I won't go too far into it now because I'm sure at some point we're talking about it. But when the discussion came to colors, I remember you really having a lot of questions about red.
About red?
About the color red, yes.
Like what kind of question?
And how it impacted you. Well, in the book, when he's first has the vision of the apple, the color red, mm-hmm. and the with the apple. I remember you going, well, how could he not already know that? And, you know, sort of being totally mystified by the fact that color was a brand new experience.
Well, I've never really been good at empathy, so that's probably why. That's interesting. And what did you tell me?
That I don't remember, I don't remember my exact words, but I just remember the experience of reading to you while you were in the bathtub.
Huh. Okay. Well, I mean, I think we can just get into the meat of the book. So one of the things for me with this book is that I really liked the overarching kind of themes of this book and the ideas, and I liked the general story. But I found that there were some inconsistencies in the world that she created, and it kind of was confusing to me a little bit. And I don't know, does me saying that to you bring up anything for you? Are there any things that you can think of that you were like, that wasn't quite right?
No, I haven't really thought about the book that way.
Okay. So one of the things for me that I couldn't quite get to jive in my mind with what she was saying was, you know, when we get to meet the giver, we find out, you know, that they can't experience pain and they don't experience fear and all this stuff. But then I was thinking about the section with Asher when they're talking about how the teachers used to like hit them with a stick. They used to give them a smack.
Yeah.
Do you remember that part?
Yes.
But if that's what they're using for discipline, is giving them a smack, wouldn't he then feel the pain of that smack? Otherwise, why would it be discipline? Like, how would that be disciplinary?
Well, I don't think they didn't feel any pain at all. I mean, that would just be a smack. I think what the giver was trying to communicate to Jonas is more like real pain, like cold, like frostbite, like...
Right, but I feel like pain is like on a spectrum, right? Like we're saying, like cold, not like chilly, but cold, like freezing, right?
Right.
And so what I'm saying is that that is, that pain is on a spectrum. So if you can feel pain for a smack, why can't you feel pain for a hit? Like, what's to differentiate his pain tolerance versus mine? You know?
Yes, I do.
Like, what might be a smack to him could be really painful to someone who has sensitive skin or something, you know?
Well,
like,
maybe, I just... Maybe yeah. The smack actually wasn't about the pain, but maybe it was about the humiliation or the embarrassment, because they were so supposed to be in line, nobody deviates, everything is the same, total sameness. So maybe his actual impact had less to do with the actual smack and more about the humiliation.
I was hoping you would say that, because I thought about that too. And I also thought that that was not, that didn't quite fit with what she's saying, because humiliation is like a feeling, right? It's something that you feel, I guess, embarrassed, you feel sad for yourself. Like, it's like some more like heavier feelings. And if you remember when they're talking about love and Jonas brings it to his mom, she's like, that's not a thing. Like, that's right. Like just a silly word. And so I was curious about that, because I felt like humiliation, it seemed like in this world, they didn't actually feel things. They only had descriptive words for what something was. So you couldn't feel love. You couldn't feel like anger. You could feel like irritated, or you could feel proud of someone, but you couldn't actually, you could be proud or you could be irritated, but you couldn't feel those things. And so that was my other thinking, why that doesn't quite make sense with the smack, because humiliation is something that you feel. Like, it's something that is something, as opposed to something that you are able to perform, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So no. I don't know. I just, there were like these little, those like little tiny things like that, that kind of got in my way of fully sinking into the world, because it's hard to show discipline or to enforce rules without some sense of pain or fear or emotional connection, at least in the world that the way that I understand
right, it. Right. And to be worried about disappointment and to not live up to someone's expectations. I agree with you.
Yeah. So that was one of the things that stuck out into my mind, particularly as a miss for the book, that there were parts of it that I think like didn't quite sit with the rest of the book. That being said, I want to talk about this idea of Jonas becoming the receiver of memories, because I think that it's really messed up.
Well, it's a horrible burden that was given to him, that's for sure, and without much success.
Sure. I just think like this idea of one 12-year-old taking on the entire world is, it just, that hit me really hard. I was like, kind of had to take a breath. I was like devastated by this idea. I think especially right now with what's all that's going on in our world and all of the things, you know, that I can imagine, because this book isn't set at a specific time, I just imagined it as a parallel world, to a parallel community to right now. So it's not just, you know, the taking on of war and death and cold and extreme hot and hunger and all those things, but it's also taking on like all of technology and social media and people who are evil and hateful, and like the fact that all of those things that we put out into the world on the internet or on television also would be on the back of this 12-year-old kid.
Right. And, you know, the receiver 10 years earlier could only bear it for 5 weeks. I mean, she and Jonas experienced it for a year. So it was too much to bear. And certainly the The giver's well aware of that.
Right. I mean, I also was kind of shocked that the giver hadn't come up with a better plan of like how to get out of this, that it took Jonas to do that. I was like, really? You have all the memories of the entire world. You know basically everything and you couldn't come up with a plan?
Well, don't you think they work together for the plan? I mean, Jonas actually executes a little different plan, but the giver and Jonas work together on the plan.
Right, right. But what I'm saying is that the whole time the giver was the giver up until he met Jonas, he never could have come up with a plan of how to get out of this.
Yeah, right?
Like, it's like, come on, giver. Like, because I feel like the reason that Jonas wanted to get out of it was because he realized, like, that there was both good and bad and that it was too much for him and that, you know, there's got to be a better way. And I just felt like the giver was like, yeah, I kind of thought that, but there's not a better way.
Right,
and I'm like,
exactly.
What do you mean? You've been in this job since you were 12 and you're an old man and you have never figured out a better plan? Like, come on, giver.
And that was all kind of relative, too. You don't really know how old the giver is because his life has been so burdensome and difficult that, I mean, if you look at the picture on the cover, he looks like a very, very old man. But there's a couple times there where his age is, it's hard to tell.
Yeah. We're going to go out of order a little bit. I always talk about the cover, but let's talk about the giver on the cover because I think you have the same edition of the book as me. It's got like a kind of tan cover with the crackly lines, and then the giver is in red and Lois Lowry is in gold. Is that the version you have?
I didn't think that was Lois Lowry. I thought that was Jonas.
No. The writing.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant her picture. Excuse me. Yes, that is it. The picture is the giver. The picture is the giver, and at the bottom is Jonas.
I don't think I have a picture of Jonas on mine.
Oh, okay. Well, mine is. It's the 25th anniversary edition.
Okay. Anyways, the point is I want to talk about the picture of the giver because in my edition of the book, it includes her Newbery Medal acceptance speech at the end.
Yes.
And she talks about who the image of the giver is. Did you read that?
I did. And it was very interesting because it was a friend of hers or an acquaintance of hers, an artist who she mentioned could see color and how much more color he could see from his very professional eye. And it made me think about how true that really is. Like, if you watch a basketball game and you think you understand basketball, but then you watch it with a basketball player, all of a sudden there's all these different layers. Or if you listen to music, but then you listen with someone who's a pianist, you get a whole different perspective about what the piano's doing in the middle of the concerto or whatever. I love the fact that what she tried to do with color is she tried to imagine how much more depth there was to Carl Nelson's knowledge of color. And she even mentioned that she still has one of his pictures on her wall.
Right. Yeah, but you left out the most important part about the guy. Do you remember?
That he went blind in his late years.
That he went blind.
Yes, and how difficult that would be to not be able to see color through those eyes. Through any eyes, but certainly through his eyes.
Right, and so that's who that giver character on the cover is. I thought that was pretty cool. I opened up because when I told everybody in the world that we were doing this book, a lot of people responded with how much they loved the book and how important the book had been to them. And so I opened it up for people to kind of send in questions or comments. And one of the things that Pete sent to us that I thought was so brilliant, and I had not even thought about it, and you kind of brought it up. He said that the color thing, the not being able to see the color, is perfect for the novel form. Because if it had been a movie or a TV show or a play, the audience would have been in on it from the beginning.
Right, exactly.
But because it's a novel, she's able to kind of like pull it out and not trick us, but, you know, the reader can't see everything either, right, as we're going through. Like, we can't rely on our assumptions. Right. And I thought that was just such a brilliant point, because I hadn't really thought about how the novel itself, the form of the novel, functions.
Well, she did make this into a movie. Have you seen it?
No, but someone else, Ruth Ann, brought up, I haven't seen the movie, so I can't speak to this, but Ruth Ann was saying she had messaged and said, why is the movie in color? And I thought that was a great point also. Oh, so I don't know how they do it in the movie.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. It's also a star-studded cast. My God.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Meryl Streep, Taylor Swift, Jeff Daniels. I was like, whoa.
I think it's something I might have to watch tonight on Netflix.
It's not on Netflix.
Oh, it's not.
No,
oh,
it's somewhere else. But also, I've heard it's terrible, so I was thinking I wasn't going to watch it.
Well, sometimes I don't like to watch the movies after I read the books. In fact, most of the time.
Yeah, it just depends for me. But I've heard this one is bad, and it's not on Netflix, and I kind of felt like, I don't know if I want to read this or watch
this. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, if it was all done in black and whites, it would become very obvious the minute the scene opens. And you don't really know that they don't see color until, you know, as it's building, until Jonas actually has this, you know, interaction with the apple, and then, you know, can't quite figure out what just happened to him, is the first inkling that that color is not part of their society.
Right. I feel like the black and white, if the movie had been in black and white, it could have worked if the movie was made in the 30s or something, you know, like where the technology is there to do color, but not really. And so a lot of movies are still in black and white, and then it becomes in color, like that would work. But now the assumption is that a movie is in color. So anything that's in black and white feels very weird and bizarre.
Right.
Like I remember, like in Schindler's List, right? Don't they have the thing where something comes in color?
Yes.
And it's red also, I believe.
Yes.
And is it an apple? It's a hat, maybe.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's
anyways.
No, and it's kind of a rusty red. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a hat.
But that is definitely, I remember when that movie came out when I was a kid, I was like, why is this movie in black and white? Like, what's happening? So I feel like if The Giver was in black and white, that people would respond in that way, and it would be a whole thing. Like, what is this? This is so weird and dumb.
Right.
And like too literal. So maybe that's why they did it in color. But I don't know how they pulled off the then seeing color.
Right.
In the movie.
Yeah. Probably worth a watch.
I don't know. You watch it and tell me. I don't think it's
worth
my time.
I'll let
you know. Okay, so this is something that is more than just about the book. This is kind of about our greater world that we're living in. So, I mean, I don't know. This is what I extrapolated. This could be totally off base, but this is one of my, you know, half-baked theories that I love to do on this podcast. So, we have this idea that communal memory of pain is bad in this world, right? Like that everybody shouldn't be able to have these memories of pain and hard times because it takes away, I guess, sameness, and it's bad for the people. It's bad for morale, essentially, right?
Right.
And that the idea is that if we had that we would repeat these things, the idea is that if we don't have this, that we won't ever have it because we can't conceive of it, essentially, right?
Right.
And I feel like in life now, there is obviously a huge communal memory of pain, and we repeat as opposed to like learning from our mistakes, right? We are repeating our pain over and over.
Right.
And I don't know. Do you think that if we didn't know what we were capable of, we wouldn't? Or do you think that we would discover new ways to hurt ourselves and others?
Well, it is really, really timely right now with what's going on with the pandemic, et cetera. I mean, if you think about it, just 2 months ago, we kind of took so much for granted, like walking into the room and hugging somebody was kind of routine. And now all of a sudden, the thought of hugging someone becomes, you know, so dramatic, or you miss it, you want it so badly because now you can't have it. I feel like it's sort of the same thing with the feeling of pain. You can't really know pleasure without knowing pain. So if you take one away, you take the other one away, the extreme of it all. So you can forget what pain feels like, and then that also means you forget the opposite, what pleasure feels like. And you have to reinvent it.
Right. But do you think that we would be better off if we couldn't experience those extremes? Like if we lived somewhere in between, like not pain and no pleasure, but a more milder versions?
Well, I think that's actually an individual trait. Like a lot of people don't really laugh loud and don't really cry hard. They sort of live a middle road. They're medium, middle of the road kinds of extreme emotions. I feel like some people choose to live their life like that, and other people are the more emotional. They cry harder. They laugh harder. They feel to greater depths. So I think we consciously decide how we're going to experience pain and how much we're going to allow it to hurt us and how much we're going to acknowledge it. And we try to draw boundaries around it.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point that you're saying that people's expression of their emotion is on a spectrum.
It's so different. Everybody's so different. And pain, I mean, for instance, you were using the example of pain. I mean, everybody's tolerance of pain is on a spectrum.
Right.
You know, what I think is a horrible pain, you might get up and say in the morning, oh, I'm feeling a slight pain, but, you know, I can push through this.
Right.
It's all relative, so...
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's all true. I guess I'm really curious about this idea of communal memory, like the communal memory of pain as opposed to the individual expression. But like, right. What does it mean for us as a society to have these communal memories of pain or pleasure or anything, these communal memories of togetherness or aloneness or whatever it looks like? If we are continuing to repeat these things over and over, right? Like this idea of like learning from your mistakes, turns out we don't really do that.
Exactly. No, we don't.
Except for in the sense that maybe we learn how to do more and worse, right? Like we might learn from our mistakes in that sense that, you know, I mean, for me, the obvious thing that always comes to mind is, you know, racism, right? Like that this country in America was founded on this idea of race. Like we created race so that we could enslave people and make other people less so that other people could be more, right? And so this communal memory of this founding trauma, right? This founding, I guess, yeah, trauma is continually perpetuated and made worse, right? Like we're not actually getting any better.
We
on
are definitely not
anti-Black racism in America. And so I'm just, what is the role of the communal memory then if it's not to do better?
Yes, I agree with you. Some lessons are not learned very easily or at all. And racism is certainly one of those.
Well, I think that the lesson of racism is learned well. I think that there are less people and institutions that want to eradicate it. I don't think it's actually that hard. I just think it means that some people who feel entitled will no longer be entitled, right? Like that's what it would mean.
Right. And so they have no motivation to do anything about the status quo.
Right. And, you know, and then the kind of like the next level, I think that the author said, Lois Lowry says in the speech she gives or something, one of the like addendums to the book, that the children are our receivers of memories.
Right.
And I felt like that was pretty devastating also, because I just feel like as adults, And, you know, like, you know, we were all children once. So I'm not like, let's not be too precious about children, because I think children are really smart and resilient and can be badass. But I think this idea that all the terrible things that everyone has ever done in this world are passed on to children, and without any explanation of what can we do to do a little bit better next time. I think that is the issue. Because I think it's okay to teach kids about dark and sad things. But I think that if we're teaching them about these memories or these events that are dark and sad, we have to be doing better about how do we go forward.
Well, children learn through their life experience how to deal with dark and sad things. Children in our society, of course, that's the opposite of what happened in The Giver. But that's how they learn. They learn from the experience of it and how to deal with it. And what I took from her saying that children are the receivers of memories, I took that as a positive, because actually your children are also the receivers of your family memory. Like, nobody else will know my life story to the extent that my children will, because they experienced my life story with me, digested it. I mean, not all of it, but, you know, I hopefully imparted some of my history to you, who then will share that with your children. And so that's how our family history is established. I actually kind of took her comment as a positive thing. Our children are the receivers of our family histories and our memories, and that's how we pass them down. And that's the difference between the utopia that Jonas lived in.
That's so interesting, because I think that so far, like this whole conversation, I feel like you have been talking much more about the individual and I've been talking much more about the group.
I think that's true, yes.
And I think that's really interesting, because for me, this whole book was like an allegory about the group, right? I mean, not technically, right. I mean, it probably is an allegory about something, but not that. And for me, everything was about the group and the greater group, and what does this mean for the greater good of society and the people. And I was way less focused on like the individual experience.
Yeah, and I totally took it as the individual experience. That's interesting. I wouldn't have even thought about it more as the group.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like because this book is taught in schools, I'm just really curious. I would love to know how teachers teach this book, because if I was a teacher, which obviously I'm not, but if I was one, I think that, or if I were one, if I were one, I think
you'd
that,
have to take English again.
Yeah, obviously. Shout out to the teachers who have good grammar. I think that I would be talking a lot more about the group and the collective and the greater sense, because that is, I think, what resonates with me on this book. Like, I'm like, when she says that children are the receivers of our memories, back to my earlier point about like slavery or the Holocaust, like I'm thinking of like really dark, horrible times, right? That like children have not experienced. So not the things that you can experience, right? Like the death of a parent or the loss of a sibling or some, you know, things that are devastating on a personal level, but things that are devastating on a communal level.
Right.
I was thinking a lot about those things and how we pass down those things either, you know, in schools or from our parents or however we learn about it. And that there's so little done in America, I can say, because I know that in other countries they handle these things differently. So I can only speak for America. But in America, we don't really talk about, like, it'll be like, this is slavery and this is what happens and it was bad. But there's no conversation about, like, and this is what the trickle down effect, right? Or
right,
like,
and this,
yeah, like, and in Germany, I know, like, with the Holocaust, they teach the Holocaust and how messed up it was and how, you know, we're never going to repeat this again. And they have this whole philosophy around, you know, sharing these communal memories with future generations and how we're going to make sure that doesn't happen again, right? And like, I know that in South Africa, they have something similar with apartheid. And of course, that doesn't mean that there aren't still Nazis in Germany or that there aren't still racists in South Africa. But there is a communal sense of educating around these painful events that I feel like is super lacking in America. And so when Lois Lowry says the children are the receivers of our memories as an American, I'm filtering it through my own lens, and I'm thinking, we've really fucked up for our kids. Because I don't remember being taught a lot of this stuff. And, like, I definitely remember being taught about slavery well before school. Like, I remember Dad and you, and same with the Holocaust. Like, I remember knowing – I don't ever remember learning that information, which means I must have known about it from an early age.
Right.
But, like, how are we teaching our kids to reckon with this stuff, I guess, is what – is what that idea, the children are the receivers of our memories, brought up to me.
Right. And how to change it. Well, I'll tell you, when I finally went to Germany, which I had no intention of ever going to Germany because of the Holocaust and because of all of the...
Well, and for people who don't know, you're Jewish.
And I'm Jewish, yes. And so I never want to spend money in Germany. I never want to support it. But when I finally did travel there just a couple years ago, I think that is what I learned and why travel is so important. Because being in Germany and seeing how often and how much a part of their history the Holocaust became, it is something that they teach to make sure it never happens again. And when we look at what happened in this country with racism, we are not teaching that. We are not making sure that we don't ever make the same mistakes again, that we make, as a matter of fact, daily almost with between, you know, Black Lives Matter and, you know, all of the inequities, and right now with the pandemic being, you know, totally a disease of zip codes, and people of color are 50% of those dying. We're not learning that message at all. We're not even trying. We even bring up reparations, and nobody wants to talk about it. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we are not teaching our children just the bare bones minimum of the history without a way to alter the history.
Right. And I think to the point about Germany as the example we'll just continue using, I think that that's because in Germany, the lesson that they're trying to teach is that we messed up and we can do better and that this was a bad thing. And I think that in America, the lesson that we're trying to teach is the one of white supremacy.
Exactly.
And so
exactly.
I think that, like, we're doing a great job of sending specific messages to children about these collective memories. It's just that the message that we're sending, I just think, is not the right one, right? But, like, there is a clear message being sent to children from a very young age. And it is deeply rooted in, you know, patriarchy and white supremacy in this country. Right. And right. Almost everything is filtered through that lens.
All you have to do is turn on the news and hear what good people these people are. Oh, these are good people, but black athletes taking a knee at a football game are sons of bitches.
Right, right, right. I mean, yeah, I think that that's pretty. I think that that's pretty an obvious playing out of a lot of what has gone on in the history. But I this is something I've always wanted to know because I, like I was just saying, I can't remember. Do you remember as a parent when you taught us about the Holocaust and about slavery as Black Jewish children?
I'm not sure that there was any one moment when you were taught. I just think in your life, you always heard us express our political leanings. And so I feel like the way you teach children is that they just experience it. So,
well, but I didn't actually experience those things.
No, experience us discussing them. I don't think you sit down and say, you know, this is what happened and this is good and this is bad. But how your parents react to the news. You just become a part of the conversation.
Right. But you and Dad weren't like talking about the Holocaust all the time.
No, we were probably never talking about the quote unquote the Holocaust, but we were talking about the injustice.
Right. But how did I learn about the actual Holocaust? Like, Like, do you remember? I guess what I'm getting at is because Jonas is 12, right, in this book, and I felt that it was particularly devastating to have a 12-year-old take on all of this stuff, it made me think about when did I start to learn about these things? And I know that for some kids who aren't necessarily Black or Jewish, slavery and the Holocaust might not come up a lot.
Do you remember going to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C.?
I do remember going to the Holocaust Museum, and I remember that I already knew about the Holocaust by the time I went to the Holocaust Museum, and I was probably 8 or 9 when we went the first time, right?
Yes, you were very young. And do you remember me having a point at which I say, you and I need to leave?
Yeah, you made us leave because you thought it was too much for me.
It was way too much. It was too much for me.
I think that's the key. I think it was too much for you. I don't think it was too much for me.
Yeah.
Because I also don't think I understood a lot of what was going on. And there was also like a kind of like a children's path that skipped some of the scarier rooms.
Right.
Do you remember that part?
Yeah, the Disneyland version of it.
It wasn't really Disneyland. It was still very much Holocaust. I just think it didn't have like some of the rooms that had like pictures of like the dead bodies and stuff. Like I think some of that stuff. But I definitely remember the room with all the shoes. Like I still went through a good portion of the museum. Right. And then I remember you made us leave. And it wasn't until I was an adult that I got to go back again.
You know, what you just said really does resonate. I thought I left because I thought it was too much for you. But you very well might be right that I left because it was just too much for me. That's interesting. I would never say I left because it was too much for me. I would always say it was because I had the kids with me.
But Brady didn't leave with us. It was just you and I that left.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Brady would have been like 12 or 13.
Yeah. I felt like he was a little older and could take more of it.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, maybe also... I have had stories from we'll call him Mr. Stacks. I've had stories from Mr. Stacks' colleagues that about the first time that their children were called the N-word. And that also is a kind of thing that I've been trying to think about myself of like when do I remember hearing about that word? And when did I learn about that word? And not in the colloquial way that I think is totally fine for Black people to use, but in the way that is used as a, you know, a racial slur.
Right.
And like with slavery. Right. And I think that you're definitely right that like it's something that you learn about like through experience. So if this is part of your family's history, right? So like if you are from a Japanese family, it might be Japanese internment. But for me, I can only speak to my experience. It's the Holocaust and it's slavery. I guess because it's part of our, you know, family history, not that our family was in the Holocaust, but just like the Jewish family history, right? Collective Judaism. Maybe it's something that was like always there, but I don't remember learning about it. I don't remember finding out that there was this thing called slavery or this thing called the Holocaust. And I just am so curious because I think that there are lots of people that they do remember, right? Like you read that book Educated or no, did I tell you not to?
Yeah, you told me not to.
Well, so there's a part where she learns about the Holocaust, and I'm like, whoa. And she's in college, so it's like, this is freaking crazy. But I think for a lot of people, they learn about the Holocaust at a certain point. Like, it might be in school, or, you know, like, they might watch a movie, and there's a swastika. And you know, maybe part of the way that I learned about it was I definitely remember there being a swastika in Sound of Music.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. You know, one thing you just said, I'm going to kind of comment on. I remember, so I think race and religion and, you know, also being mixed children, your dad and I used to always say, you know, if you live in a glass house, you can't throw stones. And you remember us saying that because, I mean, you know, we have a little bit of everything. And
sure.
I remember one time saying something to Brady, to your brother, about race. And he was a young kid at the time. And Brady said back to me, Mom, race is the smallest thing that impacts me because I have always been a mixed kid. I've always been, you know, part Jewish. I have always been all of these things. And so I don't think about it like a white kid who all of a sudden realizes that his friend is a different color. To me, it's always been something that's just my life. And it's not a big revelation.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. I think that, you know, you come to the world with your own experience.
Exactly.
But something like race is slightly different than something like an event, right? Like an atrocity. Because I feel like that is like the Holocaust is a confined event rooted in anti-Semitism, right?
Right.
But
you still, and back to the giver, you still have to keep your family's memories. I mean, that's the point. You have to keep the history, the family's history.
Right, and, the communal memory.
Exactly, exactly.
Right. No, totally. I know we kind of went on a little bit of a tangent, but that's what a podcast is, in my opinion. This is another thing in the things that didn't quite work for me in the book because it didn't quite fit in the world that Lois Lowry created. And one of the things was that there is hierarchy in this utopia, even though it pretends to be all about sameness. Did you catch that?
Yes, yes. The birth mothers were, what do they call them? The birth mothers
and then there's laborers, exactly. And there were people who like had like night jobs, and so
and Jonas's father, you know, as a nurturer, was quote unquote the head nurturer. He was sort of, you know, more respected in the nursery,
right?
There was definitely, and Jonas's mother, although it was not clear exactly what her job was, she was either some sort of lawyer, judge, sat in, you know, enforced law.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite clear, but she had a big job too.
Right. Right. And like, obviously.
And once Jonas was made the receiver, you know, the way people looked at him changed immediately.
Sure. Right. And so, that makes sense for the structure of the book, but it doesn't really make sense for the structure of the world, right? Like,
exactly.
It makes the book make sense 1,000%, and I don't think you could do it without it. But if this is really a utopia that is on sameness, everyone's job would be equally important and respected equally, even though some of the jobs are, like, the jobs are different because they need people to do different things. A farmer would be no less respected than a judge, would be no less respected than the giver, would be no less respected than a nurturer. And so, I don't know, just there were little things like that throughout the book that stuck out in my mind that like kind of irritated me as an adult. But I think as a kid, I would have probably not even really paid attention to it. And I also think as an adult 3 years ago, before I started reading books to talk about them, I think I probably wouldn't have noticed it either, if I'm being fully honest. Like, this podcast has changed the way that I read 1,000%.
Okay, now I have a question for you.
Yeah, go.
So the turning point in the book to me is, of course, when Jonas's father has to make a decision about which identical twin to, quote unquote,
get
rid of. And I had no idea that would be something that would actually resonate with you 25 years later, or I don't know, I can't quite remember what age you were when you read this, but 20 years later, how did you feel about that, being now the mother of identical twins? Was there anything that said to you, oh my God, who would have known that I would be seeing this through such different eyes?
You know, it didn't really do much for me, honestly.
Okay.
I thought it, I know what you're getting at, but it really, I don't know. I would have felt sad about it, I think, as a kid, and I would have felt sad about it 6 years ago as someone who didn't have any children. Like, I think that it's, I don't know. I didn't feel, I wasn't like, oh, my children, my identical twins, who would I kill? Because obviously I wouldn't want to kill either of them, but I wouldn't be the one to be asked to do it anyways.
Right.
It wasn't the
I just, in the middle of reading that, had this vision of your little babies in the NICU when they were born. And who could possibly make a decision like that? It was very much the turning point for me in the book as well.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a turning point in the book for sure, 1,000%. And I think that it's really sad. But I mean, I also didn't, what did you think happened for release before they told us what it was?
Well, they say, you know, they send them to elsewhere. So you think they're going to go to some other utopian society?
You thought that?
Well, I thought it in the beginning. Of course, as I got into the book, I didn't think that. But I thought,
you know, pretty much, maybe because I've kind of remembered, but I pretty much knew that those people were getting killed.
See, I that took me a while. It took me a while to know that.
Okay.
Actually, I think when it really dawned on me what was going on was when the giver was talking about Rosemary.
Mm.
When she leaves after the 5 weeks.
Right.
And then it just dawned on me and it became very clear to me.
Right.
But when Jonas is watching his father with the twins, I found it really horrific.
Yeah.
But I feel like I'm seeing it through the eyes of now being, you know, the grandmother of identical twins. And I just think it's so ironic that, you know, 20 years later, we'll be having this conversation. And here you, you know, here you are the mother of twins.
Yeah, I think it'll be harder to have this conversation when we read this book with the boys than it is now. Like, I wasn't deeply affected by it as the mother of twins any more than I think that I would have been. But I think that when they read this book and I have to talk to them about it, it'll probably be harder.
Right, right. Well, I just feel like I felt it so much more in my heart, mm-hmm. having just experienced 4 months ago these little perfect little babies being born. And how would you? I mean, and one of them did just weigh like 4 ounces less than the other one.
They were 1 ounce apart.
Was it 1 ounce? Yeah. And I mean, how would you do that? And, you know, it became very real to me.
Yeah. Okay, before we go, because we're kind of running out of time, we have to talk about the ending. No, it's okay. We always run out of time. We have to talk about the ending.
Okay.
So the ending is super ambiguous. So I just want to know what you think happens at the end of the book.
Well, so I've changed my mind. When I read the book at the end, I decided that I kind of felt like it was the end for them. Okay. And I thought he was going into some sort of, you know, horrible physical, you know, meltdown, and they were just going to be quote unquote dead, you know, because they were hungry and they were freezing and they were this and that. And then, so as I was reading it, that was my vision. But as I started to think about him hearing the music and seeing the lights, that maybe they actually did get to the next community, to the next society. So my original thought was that they pass, and then I kind of had hope that maybe they lived on. So I had both thoughts, and to be honest with you, I don't know which one's right.
Well, so, I mean, so there's one answer that I guess is the obvious and boring answer, which is that they live because there's sequels to this book, and Jonas
right.
and Gabriel are in it. But I'm going to put that to the side because I think that that's boring. I think it's like it's just not fun for a discussion. Like, sure, I guess they live, turns out.
Right.
I feel like I thought that they died 150%. I was like,
I thought so.
And like maybe I had seen that some people thought that maybe the lights and the music was them going to heaven.
Yes.
I guess. I don't know.
Yes.
Sure. That would work. Or the afterlife or whatever Jonas and Gabriel would believe in. And then I guess a lot of people thought that they like you said, like sled into like a new place with things, with music and lights and stuff. I thought that they died for sure.
Yeah, that's how I felt too. When I read it, I thought for sure they died. And then I went back and reread about the last 3 pages because I wasn't quite sure if it was obvious that they died. And then when I read it the second time, it was much more ambiguous to me. And then, of course, reading that there are sequels to this book really helped. And I'm really glad baby Gabe did not die because I was feeling so sad about that.
I was into the bleak ending. I liked it. I thought it was cool because I feel like I think I can't exactly remember my state of mind around this book as a child. Like, I definitely can't pretend that I do. But I would like to think now as an adult that the reason that I liked this book so much is because it had this like kind of bleak, ambiguous ending, right. and that the book was really serious and talked about real things. And so for me, I want the ending to be sad because I kind of want the ending to be like, yeah, there are authors that treat kids with respect and engage them on things that aren't just happy endings.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I like that. I think that that's really cool. And that also, you know, all of this could speak to the reason why I like to read books about mass murder and the Holocaust and slavery yeah. and why I'm fascinated by these kinds of things.
Right.
And why I don't love a romance novel. But, you know, so this, you know, what I'm getting at is the thing that's really great about this book is that you can bring a lot of you to it and it still works.
Yes, exactly. It'll be very, I do have to watch the movie just to see what kind of ending the movie actually has. That'll be interesting, yeah. but totally can bring your own experiences to this. Because, I mean, as we're having this conversation, you and I, you know, really read it quite differently. The whole book.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I'm curious. I mean, I keep saying this, I keep bringing this up. Teachers who teach this book in schools, please send me an email, thestacks.tracy@gmail.com. I'm just really curious what you teach when you teach this book and how you teach it and how that works. So, you know, if you have a little extra time when the school year ends and you're not doing Zoom classes or whatever, please shoot me an email. I would really love to know how you're teaching it, or people who had this book taught to you in school, if you remember how it was taught to you. Because this was a super formative book for me. Like, I remember this book. This is one of the books that I name when I talk about books that I loved as a kid and books that I loved in school. And I don't really remember how it was taught to me, but obviously it was done well because I remember the book and I think about the book as a book that I love. And so I'm just really curious about how people are teaching this book. And if it's changed, if you've been teaching for a long time, if it's changed in the last 5 years or 10 years or a year, or, you know, how were you teaching it at 20 years ago versus how are you teaching it this year, you know? Because this idea of a utopia is such bullshit. And I'm just curious how you do that, like how you engage with the idea that like there is no such thing as a perfect world.
Right. Right.
And we see the crumbling of this world.
Right.
So easily in this book.
Socialism.
Sure. I mean, but I think socialism can work.
I think it can work too, but
I don't think this is socialism.
No, this is the extreme. This is a utopia. This is an extreme. But a lot of their philosophy was based on socialism.
I mean, kind of. They have healthcare.
Yes, that's true. And education and everything. I mean, meals are brought to, everything. People go do the,
right.
Do you work to your ability and you're rewarded to your max. Or what appears to be your maximum, because quite honestly, they actually lived a minimal life.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, before we get out of here, because we didn't really talk about the title at all, and we didn't really talk about the cover, what do you think of the title, and what do you think of the cover?
I liked the cover, especially once I knew its meaning to her. And I think the title was perfect.
Yeah, I like the title. I think the title's great. I think that the title is really straightforward, but I did love the moment of the reveal when he's like, what should I call you? And he's like, call me the giver. Right. And then I also really like the cover. I don't like my edition. I don't like the color, the brown color that it is. I think it's like a really boring, ugly color, but it makes sense. I would have preferred a gray personally. I have more of a gray scale than a brown scale, like a gray more than a sepia.
Yeah.
But that's just me. and then I remember the cover that I had as a kid, I remember this, was that the original cover, the black cover with kind of like a sunset-y, orangey giver in the upper corner, torn out.
Wasn't he a little bit more scary?
No, I think it's the same picture.
Oh, it
I just
is.
Think it's like more like a photograph and less like a drawing how it is on our cover.
Yeah, because some reason your original book had to me that the giver was a little bit more ominous. You know, he was like a little more like a scary guy.
Yeah, well, it's a picture, so that might be why, as opposed to like this kind of. This one is like a picture, but not really. That one's like a black and white photo or something.
Yeah.
I like that cover a lot better than this cover, but maybe it's also because that's like my sentimental cover. And I think that, Mom, I know you're going through all of your stuff right now. I think that you're going to find my copy of The Giver in my stuff that we kept.
Oh, maybe.
If you do, pull it out so I can take a picture.
Of course I do.
Is there anything else that you want to say?
No, I just want to say thank you for spending this time with me. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, well, you're welcome. And thank you for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
For people who are listening, since this is the last episode for May, our book club pick for June is a book called Savage Appetites by Rachel Monroe. It is a true crime book, but it's like got a really different twist on it. It's about our obsession with true crime and mainly with women. It's super good. Go ahead and get your copy. Savage Appetites. We'll be discussing it the last Wednesday of June. Okay, Mom?
Yes?
Anything else?
Nope.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And we will see you guys in the stack. That's it for today. Thank you for listening, and thank you to my mom, Sue Thomas, for being our guest. Be sure to pick up your copy of Savage Appetites by Rachel Monroe as part of the Stacks Book Club. We will discuss the book on June 24th. Find everything we discussed today in the link in the show notes. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram and at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Check out our newest partner, Libro FM, and use the code THESTACKS at checkout to get 3 audiobooks for the price of 1 and to support your local bookstore while you do it. Please subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review this show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.